This right here?
OMB is preparing for what we're calling the Schumer shutdown.
That is some grade A marketing, gang. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 19th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. That was, of course, Mick Mulvaney back there in his capacity as the director of the Office of Management and Budget with the shutdown branding phrase, oh, the day. Clever, yes, but not really all that funny, right? Given, you know, the proper functioning of government in this economy. That, I know you're shocked, is where we're going to start for the next 5 minutes or so of live radio. Today, Catherine Rampell writes for The Washington Post. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, I called it yesterday an idiotic way to run a $19 trillion economy. Was I wrong?
No. This is
okay,
possibly the... I'm on your team here. This is possibly the most idiotic way to run the world's biggest economy. Markets want certainty. Businesses want certainty. Consumers want some sense of evidence that Washington is not broken. And Washington is giving them none of that at this point.
Sudeep, our government is broken. Discuss.
Yes, it's been broken for a while.
This is the wrap of one-word answers. This is amazing.
Look, we've become accustomed to broken politics and vicious partisanship, and I think we've really just become accustomed to the reality that government isn't likely to deliver what you want, which is some big, uplifting, hopeful burst of energy to drive the economy. That's not what drives the American economy. And I kind of think of it as a good sign that we could go through these silly episodes every few months or every few years and come through it in a relatively decent shape. It's not good, but it's a system that's built with some protection in it.
All right. Well, let me throw a counterfactual at you here, and Catherine, I guess you'll get this one because I'll let you discuss it with Sudeep. Imagine how good things would be if the government and the economy were working right.
Yes, that would be lovely. And I'm actually concerned about not only, you know, how much can the government do to make the economy work better, but how much it can do to minimize harm. And we're talking about, you know, of the last week, the threat of a shutdown and so on. But looking forward to basically a month from now, we're going to face another impasse potentially over the debt ceiling. And that potentially has the ability to cause a huge amount of harm, not only to the national economy, but to the global economy and global financial markets, if, in fact, Congress and the White House cannot get their act together.
Sudeep, the discussion this time around has been DACA and immigration and CHIP, the health insurance program. It's important to emphasize here we are talking about the budget for the entire federal government, of which we do not have one.
Exactly. And we all remember when the discussion used to be about Obamacare and we had a shutdown and when we were talking about Dr. Seuss on the Senate floor, all sorts of things in the prior shutdown episodes. These are not necessarily decisions that are just about economic behavior. That's the nature of our government. That's why this is all quite depressing. But we've become used to it. Maybe there's a silver lining that we've braced ourselves for this stuff.
You keep saying that.
Just I'm trying not to be depressed by it all. But we've gone through decades of this now. Decades.
Yeah, that's true. We have. Catherine, you mentioned the markets. They want certainty. Businesses want certainty. And yet today, you know, the markets were up and things are proceeding apace. I know I conjoined government and the economy, but is it possible that a large chunk of this economy has just dissociated itself from the insanity in Washington?
Yes, you know, potentially Sudeep is right. Markets and the economy and other actors in the economy are sort of shrugging off dysfunction in Washington. What would have been potentially market-moving statements by the president, by members of Congress, those kinds of impasses, fights, inflammatory remarks, what have you, are not having the same kind of resonance throughout the economy. And maybe that's a good thing. But on the other hand, you know, you could imagine that you would still want some credibility from our government and from our leadership should things go south. You know, maybe maybe it's a good thing that markets don't react so much when they do bad things, but you still want them to have the credibility so that when you want to look to them for leadership, they're there to provide some reassurance. And right now, as you said, the economy is doing pretty well. but yeah. You could imagine different scenarios.
Well, to that end, Sudeep, I want to turn here in the minute we have left to give Donald Trump credit where credit does seem to be due. I'm talking now about the Apple announcement this week of that big repatriation of money, the investment they're making. Other companies are making investments and bringing back money. They're giving workers bonuses, and some are getting raises. Is it time, really, to start talking about the Trump economy on a net positive basis?
Absolutely. A huge swath of corporate America cares about two things, lower taxes and fewer regulations. And Donald Trump either is delivering or has delivered both of them. Now, I don't necessarily think either one is going to be a paradigm changing shift for all these companies. But there's real economic activity that's supported from it. And there will at least be a burst of activity in the short term as a result. Whether any of this matters in the long term is, of course, the big question. And nobody has a meaningful answer to that at this point.
Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Have a nice weekend. Here is a phrase I heard a guy talking about the markets this week, bonds and stocks and everything. It is starting, he said, to look a little toppy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Washington, District of Columbia is, when you get right down to it, a company town. The company, of course, being the federal government, which means that essential personnel aside, basically everything grinds to a halt during a shutdown. But this is, as you know, not the first shutdown rodeo Washington has been to, and some lessons have indeed been learned that might cushion the blow. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
During the last government shutdown in 2013, garbage piled up in parts of Washington, D.C. The city's budget was frozen because it was tied to the federal government. Washington was only able to function by dipping into its emergency reserves. It won't be doing that again.
We have an exemption for our local funds during the shutdown.
That's Jenny Reed. She directs D.C.'s Office of Budget and Performance Management. She says if there's another shutdown, Washington will be able to access revenues from local taxes. Reed says that'll be enough to keep services going, like trash collection.
It doesn't matter if the next block is owned by the federal government or the district. The trash is going to be picked up no matter what.
Including at national parks in Washington, which, having learned a lesson from last time, the Interior Department will keep open for the most part. Government contractors have also gotten wiser since the last shutdown when they didn't get paid. David Berto is CEO of the Professional Services Council, a trade group for contractors. The thinking now?
Accelerate your invoices and get them in before the shutdown occurs so that those invoices can be accepted for payment.
Of course, there needs to be someone in government to sign off on those payments. It can be especially hard for contractors who aren't considered essential, says Matt Bennett of the think tank Third Way.
Those federal contractors would be at high risk of not getting paid because those are some of the easiest things to not do during a shutdown.
Bennett says if a shutdown lasts more than a few weeks, that can cause big cash flow problems for contractors. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Our corporate story today comes with a surprising bit of good news, a rarity for IBM investors the past 6 years. That's how long it's been, literally 6 years, since the company reported a rise in quarterly revenues. Not a huge jump, but a jump it was, about 4%. And it comes as the 100-year-old company makes some big changes toward services like cloud computing and data crunching, less of the hardware that IBM made its name on. One quarter of modest revenue, however, does not a convincing comeback make, as Marketplace's Renata Sago reports.
IBM's customers and what they want has changed many times since its clients first started buying computers. Here's a 1984 commercial for small business systems.
There's a special phone number he can call if he has any questions. And if there's a problem, they'll come right here and fix it.
Today, it's not so much physical computers driving sales. What IBM needs to do is conquer the cloud if it wants to compete with Google, Amazon, and Microsoft. It's lost longtime contracts to those companies. It's shuffled leadership a few times. That's why analyst David Holt at research firm CFRA says any positive revenue is big.
Take a step back. Look at where these guys came from.
From an 11% decline in 2015 to a 4% increase to end 2017.
You actually see some signs of previous investments paying off in the future for revenue growth.
He says buying cloud-based companies and expanding its services there have been IBM's smartest investment, and that to continue gains, it should stay focused on building up those areas. But hardware is still a core business for IBM, too. Rob Enderle, principal analyst for Enderle Group, says the company's new powerful mainframe set the firm apart.
IBM's got to turn those unique competencies into a competitive advantage. Otherwise, they'll continue to be a drag on the company.
IBM says it expects revenue all this year, but share prices dropped after the announcement. Investors, it seems, may not agree. I'm Renata Sego for Marketplace.
There was news of Americans' access to health care this week. Gallup reported that 3 million fewer Americans had health insurance at the end of last year as compared to 2016. It's the first time since 2014 that the uninsured rate had gone up. It's been dropping, as you might have heard, since the key provisions of Obamacare went into effect. And there are plenty of reasons why, as Dan Gorenstein reports from the Health Desk at WHYY.
After 35 years, Gretchen Miller was uninsured.
We lost it January 1st, 2017.
Miller's husband lost his job at a rock radio station in Morgantown, West Virginia, after 20 years.
I was frightened, not because of him losing the job, it was losing the insurance.
The 60-year-old, who once upon a time held jobs as a proofreader and a baker, had health problems, maybe the biggest, a slow-growing brain tumor near her optic nerve.
I need to see my neurosurgeon every year and see my oncologist every year. Oh, and my ophthalmologist to make sure that I'm not losing my sight.
Getting coverage on their own was too expensive. Medicaid was off the table, too. Miller's husband received too much in unemployment. As much as their story is unique, the Millers also are a statistic.
This increase in the uninsured rate is not even.
Dan Witters is research director of the Gallup ShareCare Wellbeing Index. Witters found that for Americans earning $36,000 or less, the uninsured rate climbed 2%. Witters also found a racial divide. More than twice as many Latinos and African Americans lost coverage compared to white Americans. Under Obamacare, those disparities had been closing.
But with the disproportionate increase in the uninsured rate among blacks and Hispanics over the last year, that has had the effect of undoing some of the benefits of the Affordable Care Act.
Going forward, some states are now expected to require people on Medicaid to work, and Congress has repealed the Obamacare mandate that people buy insurance. Healthcare experts say all that means even more Americans will lose insurance this year. The Kaiser Family Foundation's Larry Levitt says people will struggle.
The evidence is clear that people without insurance get less care, end up sicker, and frankly, die sooner.
Gretchen Miller spent her year uninsured, worried about her tumor, worried about her feet, which kept swelling up.
I've been in pain on my feet and didn't want to go and get it checked out because afraid of getting tests and are we going to pay for tests?
Miller says they bought an Obamacare plan. She jokes she's looking forward to taking fewer ibuprofen this year. But the card still hasn't come. And she's not making any appointments until it does. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You could walk over there and even get a job as a floor sweeper, and you had a pretty decent wage.
Yeah, not anymore, though, because all the jobs are leaving town. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 53 points today, about 0.2%, 26,071. NASDAQ up 40 points, 0.5%, 73.36. The S&P 500 up 12, 0.4%, 28.10. For the 5 days gone by, Dow and the NASDAQ up more than 1% apiece, S&P 500 up about 0.8%. As we mentioned, IBM posted positive revenue results, and yet the market Yeah, not convinced. IBM deleted nearly 4% today. News from the International Energy Agency that the U.S. could become the world's top oil producer sent benchmark U.S. crude futures down about 1%. See also supply-demand and that equation. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.65%, a three-year high. Keep an eye on that. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. If you're an Amazon Prime subscriber, specifically on a month-to-month basis, you might have gotten an email this morning telling you that if you want to keep getting free shipping and access to stuff like TV shows and music and ebooks, you're going to have to start paying more. Monthly Prime subscriptions are going from $10.99 to $12.99 a month. Student rates are going up by a buck. Meanwhile, the annual membership fee is staying the same. We asked Marketplace's Rima Kreis to figure out what gives here.
With this new monthly hike, Prime members who stick with it for a year will end up paying about $156. The annual membership is $99.
You know, just looking at that difference, that's a pretty heavy premium to pay for a monthly membership.
Matt Sargent is with the research and consultancy firm Megid. He says when Amazon first introduced the monthly plan a couple of years ago, it was to help attract more low and middle income customers.
They want to be able to compete with Walmart.
He says a third of U.S. households that make less than $50,000 are signed up for Amazon Prime. That compares to about half of all households earning $100,000 or more. Sargent says the company may be hiking the monthly price because it's just not sustainable.
It's much more difficult when you're dealing with a smaller income household, lower transactions, lower ticket sizes, and they're still having to deal with shipping costs, returns, fulfillment, etc.
Amazon responded to our request for comment and says it'll continue to invest in Prime content. Ron Josey, an analyst with JMP Securities, says the hike could be a way to nudge more people to sign up for the annual subscription.
And that's the upsell. If you're able to migrate those monthly subscribers to annual, I think your churn goes down.
But because of the hike, some monthly Prime members, like 51-year-old Denise Bigger, are telling Amazon, see you later.
It was like the break-it point for me with Amazon because I've been so frustrated lately.
She says she's had trouble with the video service in particular. And for her, those extra dollars a month, they're not worth it. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
It is early days yet for the year 2018, but there are already signs this is going to be a big one for electric vehicles. Bloomberg New Energy Finance, that's a research group, predicts global EV sales are going to be up 40 to 50% over last year. That is a big jump, yes. And it does, yes, need a little bit of context because context, as we like to say, is everything. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
A 40% sales increase in a year? So, is the revolution here?
In relative terms, it's impressive. In absolute terms, not so much.
Salim Morsi is with Bloomberg New Energy Finance, which crunched that impressive-sounding number. He says sales will be up a lot to 1.5 million. But in the grand scheme, that's tiny.
1 million is the number of Toyota Corollas that are sold in 1 year. Okay, so we're still talking about a very small market.
Still, it is growth. Morsi says the biggest EV markets are China and Europe because of tough emissions regulations. And the U.S., even without stricter national standards. He says that's because many states still have strong emissions goals. How big will the American EV market be? Automotive analyst Alan Baum forecasts sales of battery-powered vehicles will more than double next year. Why? Tesla.
Most of the increase in this coming year is the Model 3.
Despite production hiccups, the more affordable Tesla should begin rolling out in earnest soon, driving American sales. Longer term, lots of car makers, from Ford to Ferrari, are working on more EV offerings with an eye to the future, or for some, an eye to redemption.
VW is using electrification as a way to rebound from the diesel fiasco.
That company says all of its vehicles will be electrics or hybrids by 2030. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
We spent a whole lot of time in and around Erie, Pennsylvania in the past year trying to get a sense of what people in a county that voted Obama, and then Trump were expecting out of the new administration. What basically was on their minds?
I think that in Erie, a lot of people have lost hope.
No, government don't care about none of us. They say they do, but it's every man for himself.
We are becoming dependent on tourism.
In this area, it's a little troublesome because obviously we're an industrial town that is on its last leg of the great days of industry.
Oh, you want to live there? Well, just so you know, you can't get internet. And can't get internet is almost like saying you have to bring a bucket out to the well and pump your own water.
They asked me, what is my transportation method? When I say bus, it ends the interview.
It was a pretty strong narrative of get out, you know, that there wasn't going to be a lot of growth.
Because it does feel a little bit like this whole area has kind of had their dreams are sucked out. You're just too busy trying to live.
Economic dreams in Erie for much of that area's history have been tied to manufacturing. One company in particular, General Electric. GE used to be the biggest game in town, but the company has moved thousands of jobs out of Erie over the past couple of years. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports from the community of Lawrence Park, where life without GE is hard to imagine.
You can't live in Lawrence Park and not know GE. This entire community, the street grid, the houses, was designed and built by the company over a century ago. Jim Connolly spent his childhood here, in the shadow of GE's 350-acre facility, complete with its own train track. And 8 years ago, after college and the military, he came home to Lawrence Park and joined the ranks.
I really admired that factory when I was growing up, wondering what they did inside the fence.
What they did was manufacture locomotives. Connolly's father worked on the factory floor. Most of his high school buddies worked there, too. Then, a few years ago, GE's locomotive business started to falter, and the layoffs began. Last summer, the 40-year-old senior engineer was let go. He understood.
If you pay a guy like me $100,000 a year, and that's what I cost, or you can pay the same person with the same credentials overseas $12 an hour, it just makes sense.
But Connolly's job may not have gone overseas. He's pretty sure it went to Texas. 5 years ago, GE opened a locomotive plant in Fort Worth where its workers aren't unionized and earn less than workers in Lawrence Park. GE calls this practice of moving positions where jobs may also be renamed transfers of work. Jamie Miller, formerly CEO of GE Transportation, is GE's chief financial officer.
It's all about, you know, how do we reduce cost? How do we increase efficiency? You know, and frankly, how do we preserve U.S. jobs as we do it?
Manufacturing jobs in industries like paper mills and steel have been moving to states like Texas and Alabama for years. They're often the last stop before they cross the border. People like Greg Leroy with Good Jobs First calls it the second war among the states. And he says,
I can't think of a president who's ever blessed the war among the states like Trump did.
Leroy is referring to the speech then-president-elect Donald Trump made at the Carrier factory in Indiana.
And they can leave from state to state, and they can negotiate good deals with the different states and all of that.
Translation?
He said, you know, if companies want to bargain for the best deal they can get from a state or city here in the United States, that's fine.
5 years ago, more than 5,000 people worked at GE in Lawrence Park. Now, fewer than 2,000 have jobs there. Marjorie McLean has had a front row seat for the unraveling. Her late husband worked at GE, so did her father-in-law, two of her kids, a son-in-law, and a grandson. Up until McLean retired as a high school guidance counselor in 1989, she'd send grads there year after year.
You could walk over there and even get a job as a floor sweeper, and you had a pretty decent wage.
McLean, who's 91, even got married in a GE building. Now she's working to preserve some of this company town by having some buildings registered as historic places. As we drive by the factory, she says even after years of job losses, the memories of workers moving through the factory gates still feel fresh.
I think we accepted it at face value that the company would always be here. We never thought that they would leave.
And GE hasn't left entirely.
So we're in our virtual reality lab.
At GE, Alan Hamilton, a third-generation employee, shows me advanced manufacturing facilities. Many of the jobs that remain are high-tech and computer-driven and don't require as many workers as in the old days. To keep up, Hamilton himself has gone through retraining a couple times. And he says,
I'm very confident we'll be here many, many more years.
But Jim Connolly, who marveled at that factory as a kid, he isn't setting his sights on returning to GE. And he says losing his job last summer was a relief.
I was able to survive 3 or 4 different layoffs, and it was really causing anxiety between, should I stay with GE? Is this company growing? Do I have a future? Can I plan to retire?
He plans to go back to school for a master's and then start his own business as a consultant. In Lawrence Park, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, back to where we started, government, the shutdown thereof. Oxymoronic as this might seem, the government not being fully up and running is actually expensive. Standard & Poor's figured the 2013 shutdown, which went 16 days, took about $24 billion out of the economy, and this is going to hit President Trump in his sweet spot, it reduced quarterly economic growth by 0.6%. That's not nothing. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrials put on about 53 points today, 0.2%. NASDAQ picked up 40 points. Why does that always happen on NASDAQ? That's what I want to know. 40 points, about 0.5%. S&P 500 rose 12 points, 0.4%. Me and Peter Brady are like this. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. The executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.